I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We see disaster stories on the news all the time, whether it's the mass shooting in Oregon or a tsunami halfway across the world. It can make us feel empathic, or it can do the opposite. We can feel overwhelmed, numb, helpless. Lately, some of the disturbing images of the struggles of refugees trying to find asylum in the European Union are quite upsetting to watch. Well, how do we respond to the plight of others when the numbers seem almost unfathomable? Can we cultivate compassion? And if so, how? First, we'll speak with Joel Stonington. He's a reporter who made the journey with refugees from Serbia. We'll learn firsthand what some of their struggles are. Later, a follow-up with Dr. Stephen Post. He's the author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Healthier, Happier Life by the Simple Act of Giving. He'll help us understand how to cultivate compassion. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. How do these large pictures of disasters, how do they affect you? Helpless, numb, overwhelmed? Give us a call. So, Joel Stonington, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I want to understand this project that you've done and how it got started. What was the impetus for it?
Sure. So I was doing the story for Deutsche Welle, which is Germany's international broadcaster, and they have a show called Life Links, which they orient around themes, and the theme on this one was borders. So that seemed like a natural choice. And there were two other reporters who did other borders. One reporter went to the West Bank, and a third reporter did the U.S.-Mexico border. I went with the goal of meeting someone in Belgrade and traveling with them over the border into Budapest.
So I want to mention to our audience that you're in Berlin right now, and that's where you're based.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I'm based in Germany.
Okay. So you went to meet someone. Tell it, you and, I guess, a cameraman. Was there anyone else?
Well, so first I went alone, and I just went with I had a couple of days to meet people and sort of get the lay of the land and get a little bit better feel of what was actually happening. And so I spent 2 days in Belgrade just mostly around, there are these parks near the main bus station and train station that were just absolutely jammed full of refugees. So I just walked around and talked with people in the parks and was shooting to have someone lined up who would be willing to take us with them as they kept traveling when my cameraman landed after a couple of days.
So tell us about, you found a man named Sami. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, that's correct. Sami, yeah.
Sami. Why was he willing to do this?
Yeah, I talked with quite a few people, and there was kind of a mix of reactions. Some people were, many people were not willing to do it. I think that there was a lot of fear in Belgrade and a lot of worry about crossing that border into the EU. And he was willing to do it for a few reasons. He's had a little bit of contact with the media through, he helped sort of do some activism around helping videos get distributed to U.S. media organizations from Syria. So he's had some contact with media. As we got further into the project, there were definitely times when I think he regretted his decision.
Tell us about what was happening to him in Syria. You know, I watched the video, and there was language he used about you had to decide to go on this dark, dark path, and those are his words. What was the impetus for him to leave Syria, his home?
Yeah, so he comes from sort of an upper middle class family in Syria. He's had a very stable living experience before the war started there. His family is relatively well-to-do, and he sort of had, I think, what a lot of people in the U.S. would experience as if they were sort of, it would be similar to an American experience of an upper middle class life. He was going to university at the time when the conflict broke out, and he was living in Hama, which is maybe 100 miles from Damascus. And so the Arab Spring was happening, and there were some big protests, and he took part in the protests. And then there were these extrajudicial killings that happened where people just disappeared or were shot in the streets. And then there was sort of a somewhat calm period for a few months, and then tanks rolled into town and a whole bunch more people were murdered. And he and his family, they all made the decision that they were going to try and leave. He has a number of siblings, and most of them got out before the borders were closed.
You're talking about a relatively young man. If he was in university, what, 4 years ago, 5 years ago?
That's right. He's 28 now.
So what about his parents?
So his parents ended up going to Saudi Arabia.
Okay, and they're safe now?
Yeah, they live in Saudi Arabia now. His parents do, and actually he said that he hadn't expected that this journey. So he ended up going to Jordan and trying to find work in Jordan, but some of the neighboring countries to Syria don't allow Syrian refugees to work. So it was a very difficult time for him in Jordan, and he eventually decided that he had to make some kind of change. Saudi Arabia hasn't been incredibly welcoming to Syrian refugees either, and so he made the decision to try this trip to Europe at sort of the same time that many other people were.
How did he get around? I mean, you go to airports and buy a plane ticket?
Yeah, so if you're not coming to, like, if you're living in Jordan and you want to fly to Turkey, that's not a problem. But the trip from Turkey into Europe for refugees, for people who don't have a visa, is very, very difficult. When he was living in Jordan, he applied for asylum in Germany and was rejected. And so I think he sort of felt like he needed to make this trip and come and apply in a European country in person.
So he decided to go on this, as he calls it, dark, dark path. Did he know when he left Syria what was happening to refugees, how they were being rejected and virtually imprisoned in some countries?
Yeah, he had an understanding. I think everybody who goes on the trip is, they have an understanding of what it's going to be like, and they know that they're up against some serious challenges. He's well-educated. He's basically fluent in English. He's he knew what was going to happen, but I think he also had some things that I think it was also a lot more difficult than he was expecting. And so, yeah, we talked about that quite a lot, that it was a very, very difficult trip for him.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Joel Stonington, who lives in Berlin, Germany, and he's a freelance reporter, writer, photographer, and producer. You can find a link to this story about traveling refugees on our website, and I highly, highly recommend it. Our phone number is 888-477-9499 if you want to join the conversation. So, okay, we start off in Serbia. Serbia grants 72 hours for refugees, and this way they can get cash. It's pretty expensive journey that they're going on, considering the black market.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So he paid 1,200 euros to go from Turkey to Greece on a boat. There were four attempts, and he was successful on his fourth attempt getting into Greece. And then the other costs along the way were sort of similar. These incredibly inflated costs. The trip that boat trip was only about an hour long getting to Greece, but it's incredibly expensive because it's illegal. And so,
What do you mean expensive? Give us a sense.
So the boat trip from Turkey to Greece was 1,200 euros for him.
Wow.
And and then we encountered quite a few inflated costs when we were traveling. So we took a sort of a cheap bus up to the border with Hungary, and then they dropped us in a town that was about 5 kilometers from the border, and they were like, okay, so we had an option. We could walk to the border or we could take a taxi. And there were a bunch of taxis sitting there. And we asked the taxi, how much does it cost to get to the border? And they said, well, their first offer was 100 euros per taxi. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like that the whole way. As we were crossing the border, someone just sort of appeared out of the darkness and was like, the police are coming, and got everyone all worried. And then he said, if you pay me 100 euros each, then I'll get you safe to safety.
So what happens with people in Syria or refugees who are not upper middle class?
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me on this trip was people have to have some amount of money to do this trip that is happening now. I mean, it's just not doable without some money. You got to eat on the way. If they're gonna get places, this is not sort of a trip where people are walking the whole way. It's you have to pay for transportation. So
tell me what I mean. You know, it's a psychology show, so. You know, I'm wondering, you know, and I'm feeling quite concerned about the people without money. I mean, they're living through the same nightmare in Syria that everybody is. Do they get out? Do they just live there with their families?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, there's sort of two options. There are something in the realm of 3 million refugees sort of on the borders with Syria now. So huge refugee camps in Turkey and in Jordan. And they are full of people who do not have the means to try and make a journey like this. And then within the sort of internally displaced people in Syria, I think are in there are many, many, many millions in dire straits.
You've watched people not make it.
Yeah, absolutely. There, I'm sure. Yeah, many, many.
What was this like for you?
It was surprising to me in a number of ways. I think sort of growing up in like a middle class family in the States, I feel a certain sort of detachment from some of the things that I was seeing. And this gave me the feeling that definitely with the person that I traveled with Sami, that there just wasn't any difference between him and me. You know, he's a really smart guy. He's gone to university. He's very, very close with his family. And we had a lot of sort of heartfelt conversations, and I really connected with him as a person, and it gave me this very sort of micro view that made me care a lot more about the entire thing in a way I just kind of didn't expect.
Where did you come from? What were your emotions about this crisis before you took this on and after?
Well, so I had done some reporting on the crisis in Berlin. And first, I think maybe I just hadn't spent as much time with people or sort of connected in such a close human way with someone. I talked with people and experienced some of it just by living here. It's been a sort of a very present thing in Germany, not just this year, but for quite a while now.
So you felt this compassion for Sammy, connection, compassion, and then it spread out. You felt compassion for others.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So after we accompanied him across the border and into Budapest, we went back to the border to film some more. And I had this really incredible moment where we went and there was a sort of makeshift refugee camp where the police were stopping people. So we walked over these like now famous railroad tracks into Hungary. And then we turned left and went through these cornfields. But to get to sort of a black market where we could get a car into Budapest. So that's what we did. But if we had kept going along the railroad tracks, there was a camp there. And that's where we went to film when we went back to the border. And we were there late at night at 2 a.m. And we got there and my cameraman was filming and I just walked over to the railroad tracks and I was standing there and there was a policeman there and then some people tried to run away from the camp, so the policeman left, and I was just standing on the railroad tracks alone. It was very dark, and these shapes just were coming at me from along the railroad tracks. And it was just like one person after the next, one family after the next, like little kids. And it was just a really emotionally moving moment of just seeing this sort of wave of humanity that I had seen so many times in pictures, and suddenly I had a different personal connection to it, and it was heartbreaking.
That's what I wanted to go after. It was heartbreaking. I wonder, Joel, about feelings of helplessness or hopelessness or rage.
That is an interesting question. I think little bits and pieces of all of that. I felt like one of the biggest things was I just felt like this journey is just not necessary in so many ways. Like there are there's just this sort of these national discussions that are happening that are making this journey happen. Like Sami applied for asylum in Germany, but in order to actually get asylum, so he ended up going to Sweden. He didn't come to Germany, but in order to get asylum in one of these countries, you can't just go to the embassy in Amman in Jordan and apply. But his trip, you know, he would have saved thousands of euros. He wouldn't have had all of this incredible fear and danger, this horrible trip. That is literally life-threatening. So it just felt incredibly senseless standing there watching it. It's like it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's why I wondered about the anger, even rage. And I often say that anger is a judicial emotion. It's a reaction to injustice. You know, when you see somebody who's angry, there's inevitably they have a sense of injustice in their lives. And here you're seeing it, you know, on the world stage. You're connecting, looking, talking with people who are in horrible straits.
Yeah, it's been, yeah, it's absolutely, yeah, absolutely. It, yeah.
Where are you now emotionally vis-a-vis these refugees? How are you feeling about them? Do you look at them, feel differently when you watch what you watch on TV?
So it's been an interesting thing. So there were a number of other people that I met when I was in Belgrade who I sort of made the offer. I was like, you know, talking to them about possibly doing this trip with me. Some of them had sort of tentatively agreed. Some of them had not agreed at all. And I kept in touch with all of them. And everyone that I met that I kept in touch with is now in Germany or in Sweden. And that gives me a lot of hope. And I've sort of been texting back and forth. I got on the phone with Sami yesterday, and he's doing great. He's in this like a hotel in Sweden, and he and his friends are like playing games and having fun, and he's learning Swedish.
And what are his dreams or his plans? Dreams,
so he is trained as an engineer, and he wants to like go back to school so that he can switch his degree to something that would be accepted in Sweden. And he's learning Swedish. He is, he's going to start a life there, basically.
Tell me about you here, Joel. You said, you know, you looked at Sam and you got to know him, and you realized there is no difference. And you're talking about, you know, the middle class background, closeness to family. And I'm sure there's no difference at lots of levels, you know, dealing with your own fears. You generalized from that and felt compassion for the refugees. I wonder if that sense of expanding compassion came back to Germany with you, if you feel more compassion for more humans, even in your neighborhood, than you did before.
Yeah, I think that feeling is only a good thing. The feeling of meeting someone who you sort of see as different. You know, there's this big debate in journalism, like do we refer to people as migrants or refugees? And I came home thinking, well, we should just be referring to them as people.
Yeah.
And any time that experience happens, when sort of like other becomes same or friend or, you know, then it's just like a good expanding, as you're saying, compassion building thing. Absolutely.
You look over all these hundreds of thousands of people, and all of them are mostly good people. All of them love their families. All of them want stability, security, and well-being in their lives for them and their families. No different from you and me. No different. So, you know, I am so happy that you've made this journey, Joel. And I'm the product that you put out was just extraordinary, to see and listen to this human being living this very difficult life. It just, you know, just as a viewer, it opened my heart, and I felt love for this man, Sami. Just extraordinary, and you both are extraordinary people, and I thank you, and I thank you for being the work you do, and I thank you for being on the show.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. It's been really a pleasure.
Joel Stonington lives in Berlin, Germany. He's a freelance reporter, writer, and producer. You can find his story about traveling with Sami on our website. Please check it out. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Stephen Post, a professor of preventative population and family medicine at State University in New York and in Stony Brook. He's going to help us understand why compassion tends to shrink when the numbers get bigger and what we can do to cultivate compassion. That's all that and more coming up in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents LGBT Rabbis, a cross-movement conversation on Wednesday, October 7th. From the first woman and lesbian heading a Jewish seminary to the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi, five cross-generational leaders will share firsthand insights into their work at the intersections of religious and LGBT communities, Wednesday, October 7th at 7 p.m. For details and tickets, nmajh.org or 215-923-3811 at the corner of 5th and Market Streets in Old City.
PNC Arts Alive and Philadelphia Photo Arts Center support WHYY and announce Greater Philly Photo Day, October 9th, when everyone can take a photograph and collectively create an exhibit that depicts a day in Greater Philadelphia. More at philaphotoarts.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the refugee crisis in the Middle East and how compassion can be built, can be nurtured in the midst of all of that, and how very often the opposite happens. Compassion tends to shrink as the crisis gets bigger. We're now joined by my friend, Stephen Post. He's a professor of preventive medicine, preventative population and family medicine at Stony Brook. It's NYU, the NYU system. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan, and hello, Philadelphia.
Yeah, you're a busy guy. You're up in Calgary.
I am. They're having the annual meeting of the Good Samaritan Society of Alberta. Up here in Canada, the government funds all these programs for people with cognitive disabilities, assisted living, so many things involved with long-term care.
Wow.
It's really nice to be here, and it's a real difference.
I'll bet it's great to be there in that environment. So, I had commented that the research shows as the number of people who suffer increase, compassion tends to decrease. You know, of course that sounds counterintuitive, but look at what President Obama's reaction to the Oregon shooting and how we really have become desensitized, and he was angry. Why does this happen? Why do we become desensitized?
Compassion is easily overwhelmed, Dan. On the one hand, it's our greatest human asset. It's the thing that makes life most gratifying and most worth living, especially when we can direct it in a specific direction at a needful constituency, and when we can be effective and working from strength and seeing that we're making a difference. But if you go back and you look at the literature, people who have just a generic sense of compassion for all the suffering and struggles of humanity that we're seeing now day after day, a constant litany in the news, they actually have a little higher depression rate.
Yeah.
The ones who are highly responsive to that reality. And what is effective for them is finding a pathway, finding a particular calling, a particular way in which they can operationalize and implement their compassion and see that it makes a difference.
Well,
the global compassion is not something that people are necessarily comfortable with unless they can get involved in concrete ways to help things out.
You know, we talked, I know you were in meetings and probably didn't hear much of the interview with Joel Stonington, but, he said when he connected with one man, one refugee named Sammy, and he said, he cared deeply before all this happened, but, when he was able to make eye contact with another human, I mean, his heart opened, and he was able to make metaphorical eye contact with so many others over there. And do we need to make eye contact? I'm thinking specifically, Steve, of a very disturbing photograph of the young boy whose body was discovered face down in the sand, who drowned trying to reach one of the Greek islands from a Turkish town. And, you know, anyone who saw this was disturbed, but all of that care for that little boy doesn't translate to hundreds of thousands of people, and people don't know what to do. I mean, you know, this is partly why climate change doesn't get much traction. Like, you know, what do you do, really?
Right. Well, that particular photograph is heart-wrenching. I think that most people respond to it with a lot of compassion. But then the question is what to do about it. You know, studies indicate that people tend to be more actively responsive, Dan, to human catastrophes that are caused by nature. The tsunami wave, the earthquake in Haiti, whatever it might be, because there's a certain kind of simplicity about those moments. They're events that we can respond to, that we can resolve with effort and time, and then move beyond, although sporadically they will recur. The response to these very, very deeply entrenched problems that are essentially human creations, human social political creations, and many of these refugees are coming from Iraq and Syria. Studies show that people feel there's a kind of futility involved. This is human agency. It's not, if you will, an act of nature. These are incredibly complex situations. And so what do you do? And people tend to be more reluctant to get involved, in part because they think that any kind of a solution is largely geopolitical and not so much a matter of their own personal human agency.
Well, you know, I also look at this through the eyes of a clinician, Stephen. And, you know, when it's a natural disaster, the reaction is there, but for the grace, you know, that could happen to me. So you can identify with those people. But, boy, when we can create distance, we do, and try to convince ourselves that that couldn't happen to us. I'm thinking of a show I did years ago here on food insecurity. And we had three women here who were living that way, weren't sure of their next meal, and their children weren't. And we had callers that were actually angry at them, telling them things they should do that they're not doing. In 30 years of doing this show, that's never happened. But it was an effort to keep distance. You know, I'm not like yes. them. That couldn't happen to me.
Yeah, moral distancing and blaming is a human tendency. It gets us off the hook, if you will. And, you know, the other thing is people get busy. They're running around from point A to point B to point C in their own lives. There was a researcher, Dan, by the name of Daniel Batson, Batson, a famous guy who coined this term empathy altruism axis, meaning if you see suffering and you respond to it empathically, there is a tendency, a natural tendency to be helpful. So here's what he did. He had a preacher at Princeton Theological Seminary give a sermon on the story of the Good Samaritan. The students were very much uplifted. He also paid an actor to be out on the pavement next to the chapel steps, moaning and groaning and bleeding ketchup. the students walked out, and the vast majority of them, except for a few, just walked on by. Afterwards, Dan Batson surveyed them. He asked them, well, why didn't you come to the aid of this injured man? And the one of the major answers was, well, we had to get to class, shockingly. We had to get to school. We were busy. We were in our pathways. And I think that's another way we distance ourselves. We see suffering. We see the picture of that boy on the beach, but we focus our minds on our task of the moment and where we need to be in the next 5 and 10 minutes chronologically. It's another way that we distance ourselves from these realities.
Well, and it also addresses the futility of telling stories of inspiration and inspiring others without giving them marching orders. You know, here's what you can do to make the world a better place. Here's what you can do to make yourself feel more connected to the larger world, to make your life better. You know, we don't do that. We inspire, and then we send them off to the next class.
Yeah, very much so. And what we're doing at our medical school is having a session where we're making it possible for people to get involved in refugee medicine. We have a student who herself was a refugee as a 7-year-old child from the Sri Lankan Civil War. Her family miraculously, after 4 years in Saudi Arabia, in not very ideal conditions, wound up in New York. She wants to devote her whole life, she's a fourth-year student now, to refugee medicine and helping other medical students find the venues. You have to have Doctors Without Borders. We have a student who is a Coptic Egyptian Christian, and the Coptic Christians in the Middle East have been pretty much wiped out, and she, too, is devoted to this. But what we want to do is provide concrete, clear structures and venues so that people can take this compassionate impulse and optimize it, make a difference, and realize how effective they can be. That's why the great value in the website of our volunteer match, which you can get any place. It gives you an opportunity to volunteer for something that you're interested in, utilizing your strengths, and then it also gives you an opportunity to get together with other volunteers and kind of debrief about your experience.
All right. So
we don't take the opportunity to channel compassion in constructive, concrete ways. And with these refugees, there's a lot we could be doing.
So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, A, you're going to tell us a lot of what we could be doing. But I also want to talk about compassion fatigue, which is a real phenomenon and needs to be dealt with. So we'll talk about that after our 60-second break. That's what we're talking about today on Voices. We're talking about compassion and how compassion gets overwhelmed with these disasters, natural or otherwise. We're talking with Stephen Post. He's the author of several books, including The Hidden Gifts of Helping. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'd love to hear your experiences of what happens to you internally when you see these natural these disasters or read about them. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
Westchester University supports WHYY and is pleased to present an evening with Dan Rather on Friday, November 6th. A recipient of the Edward R. Murrow Award for Lifetime Achievement, former CBS News anchor and 60 Minutes correspondent Dan Rather has been a broadcast journalist for more than four decades. He'll share his experiences, his perspective, and his passion. Tickets and information at wcupa.ticketleap.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking with Dr. Stephen Post about compassion for in the micro and macro, compassion for, if we can have it, for hundreds of people, thousands of people, or what we're seeing now with the refugee crisis, hundreds of thousands of people. But, I want to kind of normalize those who get turned off or who don't respond. I was reading there's one theory that suggests that people expect the needs of large groups to be overwhelming to them, so they engage, their brains engage in emotional regulation so they don't get overwhelmed. It's an adaptive mechanism at one level.
Well, I think that's quite the case. This magnitude of problem is so large that it makes a lot of sense just evolutionarily for the human being to shut down their sensibilities. The complexity of it is astonishing. The layers and dimensions of it, which go back to the Iraq War, responses to that war, which go to despotic scenarios in Syria, it's also complex. There's a sense in which a natural disaster is an easier thing to process and to respond to. I also think there's a fear factor. I don't think we should be catering to it, but there is a sense of in-group preservation and what the implications would be of allowing potentially millions of refugees from a different tradition, for the most part from the Islamic tradition, which I have great respect for, but how that would affect the cultures that have been longstanding throughout the world. I think there's also an issue of countries being relatively fair and taking responsibilities equally and not simply leaving it all, for example, to the Germans.
Well, I do want to come back to the issue of how our brains are wired and evolutionary genes. I mean, if I were to just hear the voice of my own evolutionary genes, well, wait a minute, that sounded a little psychotic, but you know what I mean. I want to help my family first. I want to help my community. I want to help my ethnic or religious group first. And then if I have time or resources.
Yeah, that's very much the reality. Darwinians nowadays speak about group selection, about how some of evolution occurs between groups. So this particular group A does well and thrives versus group B, to the extent that A has empathy and compassion and helping activities wired into it. And there's a lot of brain studies that show that, in fact, when people behave empathically, the mesolimbic pathway, a part of the brain associated with feelings of joy, gets active, and even happiness chemicals like dopamine are doled out. So we are wired for it, but the flip group of in-group altruism and love is sometimes out-group hostility. Ethics is all about getting us to a shared or a sense of a common humanity, and those differences between us and them, be they religious or ethnic or racial or class or whatever they might be, those are understood really to be completely irrelevant, that we need to get to a shared humanity.
Wait,
it's a hard thing to do.
Wait a minute, pal. Is that realistic, really.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to get there? Is that really possible in our lifetime or the next or the next?
I think that there are certain conditions that can bring people together. You know, Damascus, once upon a time, was known as a place special in the world because Jews and Christians and Muslims got together famously well. And studies by Arthur Aaron and others have shown that it's partly because they're meeting each other in the marketplace, they're creating friendships, dyadic friendships and relationships between families, and through that experience they open up to whole groups, even though those groups are different. So I think we can overcome a lot of these blind spots, what racial theorists now call microaggressions. It is all wired, and the brain science, the brain scans show that we do have these reactions, and they're pretty deep, but we can also overcome them through experience, through good role models, and also, I would say, through being successful and feeling that higher gratification that comes from touching base with a shared humanity.
Okay. So I want you to do more now than inspire us. Give us concrete steps. What can I do? What can my listeners do? Starting, you know, the minute they stop listening to the show at 1 o'clock today.
Believe it or not, go to volunteermatch.org. I know that sounds simplistic, but that organization is astonishing. And they do, in fact, have opportunities in every locale for individuals to get involved in some programs that are helpful to immigrants and refugees.
So
I also want to say that...
No, go on. I want to hear. Because I want to hear more concrete steps. Volunteermatch.org.
Right. If you're in healthcare, get in, you know, Google Doctors Without Borders, which is extremely active in this area, and they're not just looking for MDs and nurses and physician assistants, but they're looking for all kinds of people who can be helpful. Doctors Without Borders was very active during the Ebola epidemic, and I personally knew a whole lot of people, again, in healthcare or outside of healthcare, who got involved in very interesting ways in that significant movement, which was quite successful.
So those
didn't all go to Africa, but they did an awful lot right here in the U.S. to be helpful.
So those are things we can join, where we can get active on the world stage and perhaps feel less helpless. What can we do with our neighbors? You know, these microaggressions. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to take it something so big that it's almost impossible, like Congress, for example, you know, and their microaggressions, but our neighbors. Going down the street here in Center City, Philadelphia, what can we do to play our part in making this human family more connected, safer?
Well, that, of course, is the great question of all time, because
that's why they pay me a fortune, is because I ask the great questions of all time.
Hey, here's the reality. You know, Gandhi loved Muslims, and he loved Hindus, and he loved Christians, and he was shot by a radical exclusivist Hindu. Martin Luther King loved white people and black people and brown people and everybody, and he talked about how we're all connected, and he was gunned down by a white supremacist. We can talk about Lincoln, Mrs. Bhutto, Rabin, Sadat, and I could throw out 50 names right now.
All right, so,
of people who over...
I want to know about Mary Smith, who's listening to the show right now.
Right.
You're scaring the hell out of her. She wants to do something. And
I think the key point for microaggressions is to interact in friendship relationships with people who are different than you are. One of our faculty members at Stony Brook, now at Stanford, Arthur Aaron, is a famous positive psychologist. And he developed, and you can Google this, your listeners can Google this, the best friends approach to microaggression. So when kids come into our university, they have a week where they are paired off dyadically with someone of a completely different background than they are, or at least as much as possible, with regard to religion, class, ethnicity, and whatever. And they spend that first week more or less together. They do things together. They pair up. They have reflection sessions. And Arthur has shown that this is actually reasonably effective. They also do some training in self-awareness, in emotional self-awareness, and where do we
look that up?
If you look under Arthur Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, and Google best friends approach, you will find.
I also, we've only got a few seconds left, Steve, and I have to believe that the work we can do that will change the world is for 90% of us to work on self-compassion. That if we can develop a sense of kindness, respect, compassion for the person we are, that generalizes. And we can develop for others, for strangers who we know. You know, suffer and want love just as much as we do. Steve, unfortunately, we are out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your meeting.
Dan, it is always such a pleasure. I just enjoy our conversations and have over the years, and you are the best of the best.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Take good care. Enjoy the conference.
Will do. Take care. Thanks.
You've been listening to Stephen Post. He's written The Hidden Gifts of Helping. My earlier guest was Joel Stonington, a freelance writer and reporter based in Germany. We've been talking about compassion on the world stage. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at whyy.org and look up my webpage. The engineer for today's show has been Diana Martinez. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is executive producer of audio content. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.